Everybody has very strong opinions, and I don't think anybody really knows. Welcome to Politicology. I'm Ron Steslow, and this is our weekly roundup, where we invite a rotating panel of experts to discuss the truth you need to know behind the most important stories of the week and how they're shaping the political landscape. And we have an outstanding panel today. Returning to the roundup is Zach Jakowski. Zach is a Democratic political consultant from North Carolina. He's a principal at Title Fight and the founder and CEO of Brackish Solutions. Previously, he has served as the campaign manager for Katie Hill's successful congressional campaign, flipping a seat from red to blue, and as our political director at the Lincoln Project in 2020. Zach, welcome back.
Ron, thanks so much for having me on today.
Also returning is Alex Thompson. Alex is Axios' national political correspondent covering the 2024 election. He was previously a White House correspondent for Politico, where he created their daily West Wing playbook. Alex, it's great to see you again. Welcome back.
Great to be here.
Up first this week, we're going to talk about how Republicans are starting the steal for November's election. Then we'll discuss the latest Wall Street Journal battleground polling and what it shows about who benefits from RFK Jr. running as an independent. After that, we'll discuss the backlash against DEI and the Democrats acknowledging some of the failures of progressive policy. Then we will find out what other political developments Alex and Zach are paying attention to and why. And finally, in a separate episode for Politicology Plus members, we're going to talk about how the push for ideological purity is stifling inquiry and the search for truth. If you are a Politicology Plus member, thank you. Politicology would not exist if it weren't for you. If you are not yet a member and you want to join us for that episode, go to politicology.com/plus to access all of those hidden episodes without any ads and join an informed and thoughtful community of pro-democracy listeners who help keep this show going. To level up right now, go to politicology.com/plus or click the link in your show notes. I think it will be no bit of news to listeners of this podcast that we need to be hypervigilant about attempts to ignore the will of voters in this election. Trump tried to do it in 2020, and he's obviously much more desperate now as his legal troubles rise. The scariest part is that this time, Republicans might do it in a way that's legal. So I want to break this down for everybody. There's a new book from law professors Larry Lessig at Harvard and Matt Seligman at Stanford arguing that a 2020 Supreme Court case, a decision, could open the door to a constitutional crisis, yet another potential constitutional crisis. We've talked about several on the show already. The case is Schiaffalo versus Washington, and it's about faithless electors in 2016. And the question in that case was whether states can make laws that direct electors how to cast their votes in the Electoral College. And the answer is yes, they have that power per the Constitution. Lessig and Seligman argue that the state legislatures could argue that they can direct electors to vote for the candidate of their choosing, not based on the popular vote in the state. There's another piece here. You can't correct errors in the electoral vote after the elector after the electors vote on December 17th of this year. So if electors are ordered by their state legislatures to vote for someone other than the person who wins the popular vote, there won't be an opportunity to correct it. And the Electoral Count Reform Act, which became law at the end of 2022, has narrowed the grounds for objecting to electoral votes in an attempt to prevent the kinds of frivolous objections that we saw in on January 6th in 2021. And it also clarifies that the vice president's role is purely ceremonial and that he or she literally cannot do what Trump wanted Pence to do. So all of this could happen so quickly that even when legal challenges arise, the window to decide them will be so narrow that the courts won't even have enough time and the votes would go through. You might be wondering, can't they just delay? Well, no, because federal law controls when those Electoral College votes are counted. It also seems, at least under their understanding of Schiaffalo, to be perfectly legal to do all of this. Donald Trump did summon the Republican leadership in Michigan's legislature to D.C. in 2020, and he tried to get them to overturn the results of the election, but they didn't. It is unlikely that a state legislature, even if they thought they could legally toss out the state's popular vote, would do something that dramatic without some kind of political cover. And this is where the FUD comes in: fear, uncertainty, and doubt about things like dead people voting, faulty voting machines, fraud in early voting, and voting by mail that we saw in 2020. In other words, there would need to be some way of convincing people the vote count can't be trusted in order to create a political rationale for ignoring the popular vote. And this presents another challenge for Republicans, because of course, Trump has kept up a steady drumbeat of attacks on mail-in voting since 2020. And earlier this month, he said to Nigel Farage, anytime the mail is involved, you're going to have cheating. It's too bad people don't say it. They don't want to say it. On the other hand, the RNC is trying to make a massive push to get voters to vote early and by mail in key battleground states because they think it'll be crucial to winning the election, because historically Republicans have always voted by mail and early. RNC chair Michael Whatley told the Washington Post he's estimating half of voters will cast their ballots before Election Day. So if they want to win the election the old-fashioned way, they need people to vote early and by mail. But if they need to use their backup plan to ignore the popular vote in states and let the legislatures choose, they probably need to build up accusations of voter fraud by demonizing voter mail. So that's a lot, but I hope I laid it out in a way that hopefully everybody can grab onto what's at stake here. So I'll put this general question to both of you. How concerned are you about the attempt to subvert the will of voters in this election, even in potentially a legal way? Alex, you want to lead?
Yeah, I mean, I think this doomsday scenario that Lauren Slesig laid out, I mean, I remember I was talking to a Republican pretty recently, and they said that their nightmare scenario is if the election is close in either direction. Because it's very possible that we could see, you know, January 6th is just the first January 6th. And that essentially, a real nightmare scenario is where you don't have just, rioters or protesters from one side, but from both sides assembling outside the Capitol and clashing with each other as the presidential election is being adjudicated. But I'd also like to say that the real people to blame here are the founding fathers, who created this crazy electoral college system as a weird compromise. They basically just like punted all the hard decisions, and now you have this really complicated system where now we have, it's supposedly popular vote, but still every state has its own rules and ability to do these, to change where the electoral college votes go. So I'd really like to just blame James Madison for making this really difficult for all of us.
He's not even here to defend himself. Come on, man, fight fair. Zach.
One thing that I just want to say is that legal and moral don't equal the same thing, right? Mm. And so, yeah, this is legal. There's a legal way to steal an election, right? Certainly not moral. I think that's the thing. I think it makes me sad how little we talk about anymore in politics. And maybe we never talked about it that much, but certainly, I mean, it's just the immorality of this plan, the existence of this plan, to me is the thing that's so concerning. And I think the thing that I'm most expecting and most worried about, and it makes me very, very sad for the youth of America, is that on election day, the election will not be over. I don't think that there is anybody who's paying attention to this that thinks election day, the votes get counted, there's a clear winner and there's a concession. Tell me if I'm wrong, but like, there's no expectation of a concession from one of the two presidential candidates from a major party. That's horrifying. That's unprecedented. I've never lived through something like this where it was this much of a likelihood, and it's not a certainty, but I think it's pretty darn close at this point that Trump's not going to concede. And I think that it's important to raise is that, you'll see, especially on Twitter, that the RNC is going to have limited funds because they're spending all this money on Trump's legal bills. And that's probably true. And it's somewhat correct. However, you look at the groups involved in this plan and they are amply funded. They are well-heeled. Many of them are C4s, so we don't even know the extent to how well-funded they are. Some are C3s, depending on how they're structured, right? And so we don't even know the full extent of what's happening behind the scenes to lay the groundwork for this election to be contested, no matter what the outcome is. And that's horrifying.
Yeah, you're getting at something. And I noticed you're being careful with your words, which I appreciate. And I have a separate question I want to come back to on that, because I think the language we use about elections, especially when they are contested, is essential. It's really important. But it's not new that both parties have a legal machine that is designed to not just challenge the design of elections and the way people vote, where drop boxes are. This has been going on for forever, for a very, very long time. And it's not just around elections. It's around districts, redistricting. I was on the Republican side of that in 2011, a long, long time ago. And so that part of this isn't new. The sort of the litigation over the rules of elections and the rules by which both parties agree to compete. What is new is how much it has escalated even prior to 2020, but especially since during 2020 and 2021, when Trump lost, I don't know what it's 60, 70 lawsuits back to back to back. So here's a question I think for you, Alex. After the 2020 election, are institutions withstood the assault on the results and the attempts to overturn them? But Trump's team, as Zach noted, also has the experience now of trying to execute this plan. I think the question is, who do you think has improved their chances of success more over the last 4 years when it comes to the election litigation component of, you know, deciding who's going to get power?
I definitely think the Trump team has, in part just because Trump won't let them forget it. The Biden team, very intentionally did reform the Electoral Count Act, which you mentioned before, in order to avoid, this idea that the vice president could reject the electoral vote. So the Biden team is not like they've sat on their laurels. That being said, the Trump team has been thinking not just about the post-election legal challenges, but I think that as they've thought over and over again, they're very ready to have lots of lawsuits before the election too. So I think, the Trump team, they were to do it over again. I mean, I've talked to legal people, they would have been much more aggressive in challenging some of the changes to voting that were made to help during the pandemic, right? Some of these ballot boxes, some of the unprecedented number of mail-in ballots, I think they would have challenged a lot of those that were done sort of by lawsuit. And so I think what you're going to see is perhaps that there's almost like two campaigns going on simultaneously. There's the campaign that we're seeing, debates, ads, everything else, but there's going to be a campaign in the courtroom, and not Trump's legal battles, but a real battle between both sides. And the Republicans are going to be legalistic way before Election Day, not just afterward.
Earlier on, you mentioned, I'm choosing my words carefully, and I am. And I think one of the things around this that makes it so tough to talk about is you really don't want to overstate anything to do with this, but you also want to make sure you really don't understate it, because this is a meaningful threat to our democracy, right? And it's hard to say that, and it's scary to say that. I think Alex is on the money. The Trump team, they have done so much to enhance their operation, to grow their operation, to expand their scope, their reach, their funding, all these things. The only thing I think that Biden's got going for him now that he didn't in 2020 is the power of the incumbency. Now, I think there's some folks on the right that might say the deep state is even more behind him now. I think that's kind of nonsense. I think that's just kind of how the federal government works. But I think the power of the incumbency is strong. I think that there is a good chance that our institutions can withstand this, but it's not 100%. And that's not good enough. It needs to be a 100% chance that democracy is going to endure. And this is an election where we do not know that.
Okay, so on this point, I want to entertain a heterodoxical question for a minute, or maybe even incendiary to some people.
Entertain on. Let's do it.
Okay. So we are so traumatized, and I mean we in the defending democracy camp, of which virtually every guest on this podcast is, by what Trump and his enablers attempted to do in 2020, 2021. And we are so primed, I think, by the bad faith of the big lie proponents of MAGAstan to judge anything Republicans might do in the realm of voting and elections to be election subversion, election theft, illegal, unconstitutional. I'm putting all these in air quotes. But we use very, very strong language to describe things that maybe those labels don't apply to. That I'm beginning to feel a little bit concerned about the way some Democrats might react to Republicans outmaneuvering them through a perfectly legal way of overriding the popular vote, as like scary as it sounds to say that out loud. So we've seen some signs of cynicism in the form of Democrats, for example, spending money to amplify messages of MAGA candidates in Republican primaries. We've talked about that on the show, believing that they'll be easier to beat. We have examples of Democratic politicians like Nina Turner and Stacey Abrams and Katie Porter, most recently, casting doubt on the legitimacy of the elections that they lost and refusing to back down from that sort of delegitimizing language. And we even have, and people will fight me over this one, but President Biden explicitly tying support for democracy with support for the current Democratic policy agenda, as he did in his Philadelphia speech. I really didn't like that. Some people didn't mind it. But so all that is to say, I have to wonder, like in a scenario where, say, the presidential election comes down to Georgia, right? And the popular vote went narrowly for Biden. And there's a cloud of doubt over the results that Republicans have created. And the Republican-controlled legislature decides to pass a law allowing it to submit a slate of electors for Trump. And they're within the bounds of their legal authority to do so. And there's no time for a constitutional challenge anyway. What happens to the politics on the left?
Oh, I mean, they'll rip each other apart. Because if you believe that literally the Republic will fall if Donald Trump wins again, then you should be willing to justify doing anything. And if you are, and you believe that you got outmaneuvered legally, then, you know, there's going to, I mean, a circular firing squad doesn't even do it justice. That being said, that my only, and I know this is not a history podcast, but one more historical reference,
yeah,
which is the, I always find sort of comfort in looking at, you know, and knowing that some things are not unprecedented. Now, you have to go pretty far back to find a scenario like yours. But if people have not read about the election of 1876, it will make you feel a lot better about what's going on right now. Because
let's have it.
Because that election was, I mean, truly, like, read about it, like, that election was stolen. And and basically, they reversed. I mean, this is right after the Civil War, right? So that's hanging over everything. But essentially, they, three states, it was Louisiana, Florida, and South Carolina, I believe, they were going to give it to the Democrat. And then there were all these allegations of fraud. And then they couldn't decide who the votes were going to go toward. And so they actually had like a completely extrajudicial committee sort through it. And eventually, on a partisan basis, I think it was like, you know, they gave it back to the Republican, who won just very narrowly. And then so, anyway, that brings comfort to me because the country still exists and we made it through that. So anyway, that's it's not great words of comfort, but I hope it helps a little bit.
You know what, Alex? It is comforting. I think it's important to say, right? Like, our country has been through some bad shit in the past and like any number of things that we can point to, and we've made it through. And I believe that we can and we will make it through this again. And I think that sometimes we make this mistake of saying, you know, everything is unprecedented. Some of the stuff that's happening right now is unprecedented. Some of it very much is precedented. And that's a good thing because we know we can get through it. But I think going back to the scenario Ron was talking about, this is what Trump does. He brings out the worst, not just in those that support him. He brings out the worst in everybody, right? So to your point, Ron, what happens in that scenario? Yeah, it's going to be chaos. It's going to, like, people are going to be big mad and there are going to be some bad outcomes on the left, you know, not just the far left, across the board. Then what's going to happen there? The right is going to use that as an excuse to escalate. Then the left will use that as an excuse to escalate. And it'll just keep kind of going up until something really bad happens or until the fever breaks. And that's been the case with Trump since 2015. And the fever hasn't broken yet. So how much worse is it going to get before it does? And is it going to? I believe it will. I think we got to let the light in. We got to let ourselves believe that we can get through this, but it might not.
Yeah, shit, it might not. Yeah, I mean, obviously the big loser is democracy in that scenario. And the question is, you know, in 2021, right, Democrats were very obviously on the side of truth and reality. And I have no reason to believe that they won't be this time. It's just that if both parties are suddenly attacking the institutions of democracy, it doesn't really stand a chance. And that's what I worry about, because then ordinary people have a very difficult time understanding what's real.
I think that's also the challenge of Trump, right? Is like, it's an unequal playing field right now, because right now Trump and his team is willing to go further. So if Democrats then meet them and are willing to go that far, then Trump and his team presumably will then go even further. And like, there's not really a solution other than just beating him at the ballot box. And the scenario you're laying out, it suggests that beating him at the ballot box isn't enough.
Okay, let's talk about RFK Jr., which we didn't do last week, even though he had announced his running mate. We had other topics on the docket, so which is just as well, because now we have some new polling. So there are a lot of very confident opinions about RFK Jr. The reality is that it's not really all that clear who he helps and who he hurts. It probably depends on where. His campaign says, yes, we are a spoiler for both Trump and Biden. The Wall Street Journal released battleground state polling this week. Trump leads Biden in 6 of the 7 states they polled. Wisconsin was even. Trump was between +1 and +6 with a margin of error of +/-4. There are a couple of key things to look at here. If you compare this to the New York Times poll back from November, in the head-to-head, Biden has gained ground in 4 of the 6 states that the Times polled. He gained 5 points in Georgia, 2 points in Michigan, 7 in Nevada, and 1 in Pennsylvania. Trump held at +5 in Arizona. Trump gained in Wisconsin. Biden was +2, now he's even. The RFK Jr. factor in the Wall Street Journal poll breaks down this way. He helped Trump in Georgia, Michigan, and North Carolina. He helped Biden in Wisconsin. And the margin was basically a wash in Arizona, Nevada, and Pennsylvania. And for what it's worth, the New York Times poll in November, RFK Jr. helped Biden more in Arizona, Michigan, Nevada, and Wisconsin. But RFK's numbers have been halved since then. He did name his running mate last week. He selected Nicole Shanahan, who's an attorney, tech entrepreneur. And before this, she was most famous for a Wall Street Journal article accusing her and Elon Musk of having an affair when she was married to Google co-founder Sergey Brin. Musk and Shanahan have both strongly denied that. Since he's running as an independent, RFK Jr. had to announce his running mate early. That is because almost half the states require a VP pick to get on the ballot if you're an independent, which is, as a side note, yet another way independent candidacies are disadvantaged by election law created by the dominant parties. Shanahan has deep pockets. That divorce settlement with Brin is confidential, but she initially asked for more than $1 billion. And Kennedy's campaign is strapped for cash. In their last filing, ending February 29th, they had $5 million cash on hand. And of course, they have the additional expense of getting on the ballot as an independent campaign. I have a note here that Nate Silver, about a half hour ago, tweeted, always a little dangerous to eyeball this, but Biden head-to-heads versus Trump definitely look better lately. Model coming soon. How did you both react to this Wall Street Journal poll? What do you think it means for the state of the race now 7 months out, Alex?
Well, I think it still shows that if the election were held tomorrow, Trump probably wins, which basically every poll has shown. Now, if you are Joe Biden, you would take solace in the fact that things are going now in the right direction, not the wrong direction. And, you know, Trump is pretty much stuck below 50%, which means that there is a non-Trump, non-MAGA majority in this country. If he can tap into it. But, you know, on the RFK Jr. thing, it is fascinating because no one would ever classify RFK Jr. as a moderate. And yet he is taking from both sides. You know, he has the luster of the Kennedy name and his dad's namesake, which clearly, you know, a lot of Democrats still love and admire. At the same time, you know, his both because conservative media really propped him up early on to help hurt Biden, but also because his politics, I mean, outside of the vaccine stuff, you know, his politics are very much for like the disillusioned, right? The people that don't believe in the system anymore, which has been, you know, which has been Trump's message. So it has been fascinating that even though he is not a moderate, he is taking from both sides. And as a result, you are seeing both campaigns and both teams just like, you know, doggy pile on him. Democrats are saying that he's a Trump plant And the Trump team is saying that he's a Green New Deal climate extremist. And so it's been, you know, fascinating to watch. I don't think we've had a third party candidate like this, at least that I can remember.
Zach, what do you make of how confident people are in their predictions about RFK Jr.? I'm not talking about voters' attitudes, but in the sort of the, you know, the consultant class and the talking class of how confident they are and who he's going to hurt. Because everybody has very strong opinions and I don't think anybody really knows.
I wish that they had like some way of tracking pundit statements and then how often they pan out to be right and had like a batting average for pundits, because they speak with certainty and like, hey, I'm guilty of it too sometimes. And yet, like, hey, Hillary didn't win in 2016. What? You know, so look, I think there is this tone of certainty around RFK. I actually am very much of the mind that while I think it's more likely than not, he will pull more from Biden than Trump. I think he might pull more from Trump. Here's a reason why, for example, President Trump, and I'm about to do something odd for me, I'm about to praise him. His administration presided over the rollout and creation, or the creation of a life-changing, world-changing vaccine that I think was a great societal good. And it helped us get back from the pandemic. And that's fantastic. Guess what? There's a whole lot of anti-vaxxers that are part of Trump's coalition. I think they would absolutely prefer RFK Jr.'s stance on that issue. Okay. So there's an opportunity there, right? Electorally. So I think this idea that, oh, he's absolutely going to hurt Biden is kind of laughable. I think it's more likely than not that he will, but we don't know that. I mean, going back to the horse race coverage, I think that certainly these are encouraging trends for Biden, but I also think we spend far too much time talking about the horse race stuff. We should be looking at the fundamentals. We should be looking at policy stuff. You know, we're so far away. Most normal people are not paying attention. Most normal people, like, they still haven't accepted that Trump and Biden are doing this again. And they're going to be pissed when they do. Like, the average voter doesn't think about the election until about 2 weeks before they cast a vote. So, you know, I find polling at this stage to be the useful snapshot of the moment, but not particularly interesting.
I think it's also worth noting or just reminding people that he originally launched his campaign as a Democrat. It wasn't launched as an independent bid. He wanted to run against Biden in a Democratic primary, but the Democratic Party machine pretty much, you know, wouldn't give him the time of day. So
related to that, Ron.
Yeah,
there was just a great graphic that came out, and I'll try and track it down later. That showed how many times RFK Jr. was mentioned on Fox when he was running as a Democrat versus how many times he's been mentioned now as an independent. And you'll be shocked to learn it's significantly fewer. Which I would argue backs up my case that, in fact, he might not be a certainty to hurt Biden.
Yep. I mean, there's a lot of people at Fox who don't want Trump back again.
I also just want to say that I support this pundit accountability movement that I believe that we're starting today.
It would be a really good one.
With AI, we can do it, right? Like, there's got to be a way to do that.
Yeah. Last question on RFK Jr. What should we take away from this pick of a vice presidential candidate who I had never heard of before and probably most people had never heard of before? I guess not really like who she's going to play to, but what does it tell us about how he's positioning the campaign? Is it just for money, or is there something else we can learn from this pick?
I don't think anyone really votes on the basis of the vice president. I have found it a little bit interesting and strange that she has not done an extensive, you know, interview or sit down. Maybe she's, you know, going through extensive media training. I think she gave like a decent speech. You know, the biggest hurdle for her is going to be, I think she's 38. Does it seem like an amateur pick? Does it seem that he only did it for money and that he just picked, you know, a rich person and someone that would clearly not, you know, be ready to be, you know, take the reins of the Oval Office, that could end up, you know, hurting his bid, long shot as it is, it would look even, you know, more cynical. So that's what I would say. You know, she does have a little bit of a hurdle in terms of proving that, you know, she can, you know, do the job, and that doesn't, in a way that doesn't completely undermine his candidacy.
Yeah. Content aside, I thought the speech came across as really authentic, actually. She came across as like very relatable, like a normal human being, not a politician. Go ahead, Zach.
the billionaire came across as
Wendell. The normal billionaire, probably. Yeah.
I mean, yeah, I think, yeah, it's great to see another blue collar billionaire running for president or vice president. I think, look, if she pumps $1 billion into the campaign, he did a great job with his VP pick. You know, if she pumps in $10 million, okay, then less so, right? I think her value add is going to be based on how much money she's bringing to the table. And so I think time will tell. I guess I will also say that, like, it's nice to see like a young person involved at the highest level. You know, I'm certainly not going to vote for RFK Jr. or her, but it does, I guess maybe there's some value there, and there being the contrast that there's at least one young person involved in this.
Okay, let's talk about progressivism. In our January 5th plus segment, I said that I thought DEI was going to become a political liability for Democrats. And I think I surprised the people on the panel that day, in part because I thought it was inevitable that more people were going to learn what the programs of DEI offices actually do in practice, and the ideology associated with it are very different from the first impressions a lot of people get from the noble words of diversity, equity, and inclusion. I took a deep dive in this subject last year with the liberal political scientist, Professor Yasha Monk, called The Identity Synthesis. And Yasha was very helpful in explaining how this often results in illiberal policies. It looks like the tide is finally turning, and that backlash is here, and it is real. Axios is reporting that companies are backing away from DEI. Mentions of DEI on quarterly earnings calls are now down from over 300 in 2021 to 74 in the first quarter this year. Johnny Taylor, president of SHRM, the Society for Human Resource Management, says, quote, "The backlash is real, and I mean in ways that I've actually never seen it before. CEOs are literally putting the brakes on this DE&I work that was running strong. Some businesses are trimming DEI staff and cutting back on resources for workers of different races, ethnicities, or interests. There are some companies making changes because of lawsuits." You will recall the Supreme Court ending affirmative action, and that is discriminating on the basis of race in hiring, in admissions, college admissions. Some companies are choosing not to use the title DEI. All of this is happening as Democrats are now pushing back against their left flank and acknowledging some of the failures of being too progressive. And in that basket, I would put Oregon restoring criminal penalties for possession of even small amounts of hard drugs. They've made it made possession of small amounts of heroin and methamphetamine criminal again. This reverses a ballot initiative that decriminalized the drugs in 2020. An outreach worker with Recovery Works Northwest told NBC News, quote, "We were too progressive." And then I came across the tweets of one Brianna Wu, who is also executive director. She's a former congressional candidate. She's also executive director of Rebellion PAC, which is a hybrid PAC she founded with Cenk Uygur. She's been posting on X a lot the last several days. So I'm just going to read a couple of excerpts from one tweet. "I am not convinced progressivism is a force for good in American politics anymore. Right now, you're in New York chanting bomb Tel Aviv and siding with the actual theocratic terrorists. It's because you can't run a civil rights movement by telling everyone who disagrees with you to shut up. It's because talking to Republicans is seen as betrayal, something you have to do in a democracy. It's because you can't form a coalition to do anything because no one is interested in getting along with anyone. It's because the policies we are advocating are getting stupider and stupider, and no one can say so. It's because the movement is a panopticon police state where you cannot say anything out of step with the extreme, or you get devoured by cannibals hoping for clout. You can't even say hideous flag design isn't good because your DMs will fill with angry people. That literally happened yesterday. My politics have not changed. My appraisal of who is able to get the public policy I believe in passed has. This is a cultural dead end. I'm going to go work with the Democrats who can act like adults." So, and indeed, Alex, you wrote a piece on April 1st, which was not an April Fool's joke, about how the Trump campaign and allies are now planning to flip the script on anti-racism by focusing on anti-white racism. What is the political opportunity that they see?
They see the opportunity that's related to the first thing that you talked about, which is that there is a basically silent DEI backlash. I mean, some people are being outright and very public with it, but mostly because people are just talking about it less and bragging about it less, and they're scaling back a lot of their programs. And the Trump campaign is essentially betting that they can ride some of this DEI backlash, especially among like white voters. And so what they're planning to do is essentially they're trying to in the Black Lives Matter era, they're trying to all lives matter everything, essentially, which is that, you know, these civil rights laws were made, to protect, especially, Black and Latino and Asian Americans, that when they were passed, they were especially focused on Black Americans. Now they're arguing that there is that the civil rights laws need to apply to white people as much, and they are going to dramatically refocus the implementation of these laws on any perceived discrimination against white people. And the real, in a practical way, here's what that means: is that if there's any government program that is designed to benefit minority communities, Trump Justice Department would almost certainly eliminate it and say, or you would have to, that program has to be be able to be accessed by white people. It also would mean that you could see a Trump Justice Department basically sue any private company that has anything resembling, a program to promote minorities or to, help this, help bolster diversity within their companies. Stephen Miller's group, for instance, has already filed a civil rights complaint using the Civil Rights Act of 1964 against the NFL for its Rooney Rule, which, if you don't know, it basically requires NFL teams to interview minority candidates for open coaching positions, GM positions, etc. And they argue that that implicitly discriminates against white candidates. So, what they are basically betting that there is a much wider DI backlash than maybe is showing up.
Zach, my question to you is, what took so long?
Well, the pendulum swings one way, it swings the other, right? And so it took a while for us to get to this point. And now it's going back the other way, and that's just politics, right? So I don't think this is a particularly unusual series of developments on paper. I will also say, though, what is the largest demographic voting block in the U.S.? It's white voters. What is the largest demographic voting block in the Republican Party? It's white voters. So, electorally, I can understand why they're pushing this. I think that they're bad policies. I think, I'm a white guy. I probably would stand to benefit someone from these policies, and I don't want them, But I think that's not the attitude of Trump's base and Trump's voters. Going back to, the excess and the overreach of kind of the progressives on this, again, I think this is a normal social movement thing, right? Things, they move, they go a little past the general public's comfort zone, they come back a little bit, right? This is how it goes. But I also think this is an exercise in how echo chambers can be bad. You get in a room with like-minded folks, and it feels really good because, we're all kind of on the same page. We all kind of agree, we're all on the same team. And then stuff starts to go off the rails. And I think that's what's happening right now, particularly with, it's not just the far left, it's happening, with any number of other groups. I think the far right in particular, you're seeing the online discourse there around women and how to include them or whether to include them in the movement is totally off the rails. And the left with some of the stuff they're saying, the far left and some of the stuff they're saying with Israel is off the rails too. Some of the stuff around DEI policies can be a little strident. I don't know if y'all been following the DoorDash discourse. That's another one, with ableism, where it's insane. It's obviously not anywhere near median viewpoint that DoorDash is a human right. Okay.
Is that an argument?
Oh yeah, man. So listeners, if you haven't been following the DoorDash ableism discourse on Twitter, just dive in. It's a blast. I think a lot of it is bots pushing it, and a lot of it is nonsense. But there are some very well-intentioned, earnest people that have arrived at some ridiculous conclusions, right? And I think we're seeing that in other areas with the far left. And I think it's gonna it has the potential to hurt folks electorally in the party, but I think it's coming back. I think we're seeing it kind of get rolled back. I think we're seeing party elites start to acknowledge like, oh, we're actually going to do a little bit less of some of this stuff now. And I think it'll be more or less fine down the road. Ron, I want to ask you a question though about that.
Okay. About which thing? DoorDash?
So, you know, we talked about this not on the pod a bunch of times. And my attitude is like, it's going to go too far. It's going to come back. It's going to be fine. That's not always your attitude. How do you think this plays out?
So I think Alex is right that, okay, so the DEI backlash is real. I think Alex is right that maybe it isn't as strong as it could be yet. I think the Trump campaign is obviously seizing on something quite real. And they have an incentive to, and certainly no qualms with playing up the sort of the white grievance that is rooted in racism to rail against these policies and to, I think, paint with a very broad brush. Sorry, what was your question to me?
I look at the kind of progressive overreach and I think it's going to come back to reality. And I think that things are going to be more or less fine. Do you also feel that way?
I don't feel that way.
Okay.
I'm not that confident. I'm not certainly not as confident as you are because I've I think when Liz was on, I said DEI is a bad thing. And her eyes just like popped open and she was like, wait, what? Really? You really think that? I was like, yes, because I know, because I like diversity and inclusion, but what these programs stand for and what they do in practice often amount to the opposite of what those words are. And so, and I've taken a deep dive on the ideology behind it. And Yasha's book is actually excellent. I would recommend anybody go read it because he sort of goes into the intellectual and philosophical history of the what he calls the identity synthesis. And the reason I'm not as optimistic as you are is because of just how deeply entrenched it is in the I would say expert class of America. You could say elites if you want to, but that's kind of a loaded term now. But if you think about the percentage of academics, percentage of experts are Democrats. It's overwhelming in every conceivable category, except for maybe, engineering. That there's an orthodoxy of thought, an ideology. It is true that there's an ideology that underlies the diversity, equity, and inclusion industry. And I think it's so interwoven with this, with a deep leftist illiberalism that I don't think it's going to be as easy to just snap back, for the pendulum to just snap back to some sense of normalcy, that it will continue, but we are seeing the first backlash and that there will be more in the future as more people come to understand the implications of the underlying ideology. But right now, I think that's just beginning and that the superficial, the good faith that has been accumulated by the words diversity, equity, and inclusion is going to start to give way to more scrutiny as we apply more scrutiny to it. It's going to give way to a better sense of what's actually going on.
I would
on
also
there.
Argue, if you're a listener and you're supportive of DEI and DEI programs, I think that over time that this is an uncomfortable moment, but ultimately this is going to be a good thing. And here's why.
Yeah.
I've sat through a bunch of these trainings and I hate to be the guy to say this, like they suck. Like they're not good. I don't walk out of those trainings thinking like, wow, like I feel like more optimistic about the world and I feel like I'm going to be able to do all these things to create a more inclusive space. I feel like I don't want to sit through another one of those trainings unless I absolutely have to most of the time. And maybe that's because I'm a white guy and maybe that's like a regressive worldview, but like I've been working for Democratic candidates since 2012. I'm a good Democrat. I do good Democratic things as best I can, but the trainings are just not particularly good. Like they're not there. Like and maybe I've had bad luck. They haven't been engaging. I haven't felt like I've learned things that have helped open my eyes to stuff that I've been aware of. I have sat through a few where I felt like somebody's just trauma dumped and it's been deeply uncomfortable. Sorry, Ron, you're probably going to get some like nasty emails about that,
That's
but it's
right.
true. Like
I'll
the
send
trainings,
them to you.
And I say this in the long-winded way of saying, the trainings are going to get better. They're going to get more informative. They're going to be better, more likely to get the outcome that they claim to be seeking. Because right now, and like there's ample data that shows this, when people do a DEI training, they don't emerge with a more broad worldview. They emerge not wanting to do another DEI training.
Yeah. And to be clear, the policies that are being most heavily scrutinized and rolled back right now are the ones that that call for things like quotas in hiring, that call for explicit racial discrimination in hiring practices. And you can see that in the training materials. And those are the kinds of things that are that, you know, the lawyers on the corporate side are worried about lawsuits, rightly worried about lawsuits for, because you're not supposed to discriminate on the basis of race, no matter which direction you're doing that in. So I think the thing that will help to move the conversation in a more constructive direction are lines of argument that people like Coleman Hughes are developing and advocating for, which is rather than a sort of obsessive focus on identity characteristics like race, that we should be pursuing class-based policies that help, for example, if you want to help poor people, help all poor people, as opposed to targeting a specific race of people. And so I think when we see more people arguing for class-based policies as an answer to the racialization of our politics, then I think the conversation is going to move in a more constructive direction. Actually, let's reach out to Coleman and see if he wants to come on. He has a book out called The End of Race Politics. And he's been doing some really great interviews. So I recommend that also.
I'm so curious from Alex, like, do you find the most of the coverage that you see is through a race-based lens or through more of like a class-based lens?
A few things. One, I do think there's probably more in this current media environment, especially as things have become nationalized and reporters, you can see in just the demographics, well, that reporting has become much more of a white-collar profession. Definitely, I don't know if there's any reporters I know in our newsroom or almost maybe any newsroom I've worked in that didn't have a bachelor's degree. And that certainly didn't used to be the case. As a result, I mean, I've been in a lot of diverse newsrooms. So I think the coverage has become certainly much more, much more balanced. But the class coverage, I think, has really struggled, which is why I think the appeal of Trump still does seem to surprise a lot of people in the media. The other thing is, I mean, America, especially, I would also say, especially white America, is really, bad at talking about race. It always has been. And, I think even sort of this faux gauzy memories of the civil rights era really downplay how ugly that got at some of these points. And, the DEI movement is part of an effort to address some of the longstanding, the legacy of, discrimination. But then, anytime the problem is every time you try to address past wrongs, then you also prompt a backlash from sometimes in this case, like white people that are like, well, I didn't do anything and I'm also suffering. And so, I think that's, it's interesting that Coleman's book is the end of race politics, because I don't think there's ever going to be an end of race politics in America. And it's just, it's how we started. And I think it's going to always be there.
Okay. Now that we're up to speed on some of the big stories this week, let's find out what our panel is paying attention to. Alex, what'd you bring?
I think the last time we were on, I was going to be curious if the State of the Union, if there was going to be a real bounce, and it appears that there was. I think the thing that I'm going to be looking for now is how the Republicans get on the off-ramp to impeachment. You remember they did vote to do a real impeachment inquiry, and my assumption at the time was that if you have enough votes for an impeachment inquiry, then you definitely have enough votes for impeachment. That does not appear to be the case. And James Comer is trying to figure out a way to get an off-ramp in a way that is not going to be humiliating for him. And, you know, how does he do that? They're going to probably do criminal referrals. They're probably never going to actually close the impeachment inquiry. But it has been really stunning to me to see how quickly it collapsed. My sort of understanding is, you know, I think that he probably internally sort of overpromised and then underdelivered. And you can see the real I'm really also curious to see if the internal frustrations with how James Comer has led this impeachment inquiry become more public as it begins to wind down. So that's something I'm going to be watching the next few weeks.
It's a really great one because we almost picked that for a topic today. And I was wondering what you thought they were going to do next. Like, where do they go to dig next? If given that the, you know, the Biden business dealings line of inquiry has completely fallen apart,
they already had their star witness, right? When they had Hunter Biden in, they ended the interview early. Like, it was like they had him and they literally could have gone 8 hours, 10 hours. Like, you know, they had him for the full day. And then they got to like 5:30, 6 p.m. They're like, I guess we have no more questions. So it's just, I don't know where else, unless there is yet another Hunter Biden laptop out there, that becomes public before the election day. I just don't know where it's going to be.
All right. I got a couple quick things. First of all, last week on the roundup, I veered off into an explanation about the politics of monetary policy and why it mattered. And I was feeling very nerdy and vulnerable in that people weren't going to want to hear more about that. So I asked you all to write in and tell me, like, either shut up or give us more of this. And thank you to Nancy, Barbara, Jackson, Corey, Diana, Karen, Rich, Eddie, Steven. You made my day because we didn't get one email from somebody who said, I don't want to hear more about this. As a matter of fact, everybody else wrote, I've never heard anybody talk about this in a way that's accessible, and I'd like to understand this better. And yes, please give us more. And also, someone said, like, this would never be on my list of things to learn about, but you made it interesting. So thank you, you guys. That really meant a lot. So we will do more of that in the future. I won't overwhelm you, but we will come back to it. The other one is, I'm just watching Janet Yellen's mission right now, which is she's sounding an alarm. So there's been a series of headlines recently, the last week, and now she's going to China, but she's warning, here's one from the New York Times. Yellen warns against flood of cheap green energy exports. One quote is China, she's concerned about China's, quote, excess industrial production, warped supply chains. Another one, Yellen sounds alarm on glut of Chinese clean energy exports. Another one, Janet Yellen says U.S. will protect green tech from China competition. So this is the language in these articles is very interesting to me, because if you parse it, what this really means is China is capable of producing a lot of very cheap, green-friendly technology products and exporting them everywhere. And we could be speeding up our transition to renewable energy products, but we don't want them to do it because it will impact the effort for U.S. domestic production to ramp up under the Inflation Reduction Act. And so, like, there's this trade conflict happening where it sort of pits the big picture environmental goals against U.S. domestic supply production. And I think it's very interesting to me because, you know, the part about actually if we use Chinese goods, it might be good for the environment is being left out of a lot of this because of U.S. domestic production interests. I'm just interested to see how this develops. And I'm really just watching to see how they message this because it's a very, you know, America first kind of economic policy. So, Zach, what do you got?
I am watching women's sports right now. So like 13 million other Americans, I watched the LSU-Iowa game. It was fantastic. And I think we are seeing a level of viewership, which is going to lead to a level of money that is historic for women's sports in basketball. But also we're seeing it in tennis. So the WTA, the Women's Tennis Association, just announced they're going to be having their year-end finals in Saudi Arabia, in Riyadh, something that many of the players on the tour have protested, have said explicitly they do not want. because of where Saudi Arabia is on human rights, specifically on women's rights. And so we're seeing this amazing thing happening, which is there's more interest, there's more participation, there's more money for women's sports. And that's a good thing. But we're also seeing some really bad stuff and some sports washing creep into it. And so I think that's going to be a space that's going to be impactful for any number of reasons over the coming years. And I also think, like everything sports related right now, it intersects with gambling, which the prevalence and the legalization, I think, just continues to be obviously going to have disastrous consequences. We are cruising towards a really, really bad place with gambling in this country. And I hope that that doesn't taint the emergence of women's sports, but certainly we'd be kidding ourselves if we pretended like it couldn't. And also, Ron, I owe folks an apology. Last time I was on, I talked a little bit about Kategate. And yeah, there were a bunch of conspiracies floating around. I was wrong about every single one of them. I thought it might be a funny thing. Nothing funny about that. Obviously wishing Kate well, and I got that one wrong.
All right. Before we head over to Politicology Plus, where we are going to talk about, I didn't even tease this at the top, both Lab Leak and the Origins of Humanity. Where can everybody find you on the internet, Alex?
You can find me on X at Alex Thomp, T-H-O-M-P, or at Axios.com.
Zach?
Unfortunately, you can still find me on X.com at Zach C-Z. Zach spelled the correct way, Z-A-C-K, Zach, not Zach. And then you can also find some of my work at VFRL.org, Veterans for Responsible Leadership. It's a fantastic group that I'm happy to plug that's working hard to protect our democracy.
All right, everybody. Thanks for listening today. If you have questions about anything we discussed today, you can reach us, as always, at podcast@politicology.com. Whether it's an episode idea, a topic recommendation, or just a simple note about what you thought, we love to hear from you, and we might even use it on an upcoming episode. Also, if you can head over to the Apple Podcast app and rate us 5 stars and leave a review there, we'd really appreciate it. This helps us rise in the rankings so that new people can discover Politicology organically. I'm Ron Steslow, and I'll see you in the next episode.